Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sunny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am sleepy, but happy to be here.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, movie stars are getting older. I mean, obviously.
Aren't we all?
In the sense of time moving only in one direction, and movie stars being people who are trapped in the time stream, we're all churning inevitably toward the grave. So yes, they're getting older. But a new report from NRG Research Group shows that when movie-going audiences are asked who they would pay to see in a movie, the poll results demonstrated with some brutality that the idea of paying to see someone in a movie theater is defined by age. What I mean is, of the top 25 names, only one star was under the age of 45. Zendaya, the number one name given by audiences, Denzel Washington, a spry 70, while the top five was rounded out by Tom Cruise, Dwayne Johnson, Brad Pitt, and Ryan Reynolds. In his write-up of the report, Matt Bellany over at Puck noted that millennials and younger weren't entirely absent from the top 100. 15 actors under the age of 40 made the list, including some notable names like Timothy Chalamet, who clocked in at 36, and Jenna Ortega at 56. What's interesting, though, is that the stars that Gen Z itself looks for theatrically are also a little older. Yes, younger stars like Zendaya, Tom Holland, Timothy Chalamet, etc., are higher on the Gen Z list. But their top five is Dwayne Johnson, Ryan Reynolds, Kevin Hart, Tom Cruise, Adam Sandler. It seems that the very idea of quote-unquote movie stardom feels like an artifact of an earlier era to younger audiences. And an earlier era means stars from that era. It's also worth noting that the younger generation of stars are hard to separate from the franchises and intellectual property they're attached to, right? There's a chicken and an egg thing here, of course, right? The reason Zendaya gets cast in something like Dune is because she appeals to younger demographics. I don't know if you guys remember, there were howls of outrage when the first film came out because she was barely in it. She's in it for like 15 minutes at the end of the movie. And Gen Z was like, what's going on with this? Why isn't Zendaya in our movie? We came to see the Zendaya movie. She's not here. Is Tom Holland a star because he's a star, or is he a star because he's Spider-Man, right? He plays the biggest character in movies. Spider-Man is almost objectively the number one IP character, and he plays it. Is he just inseparable from that? Is Jenna Ortega a star, or is she popular because she's in Scream and Beetlejuice 2 and plays Wednesday Addams? It's hard to say. But I do think a movie like Challengers, for instance, gets to 100 million worldwide, gets to nearly 100 million worldwide, with a replacement level movie star in the Zendaya role. She put butts in seats. It's what all the polling will tell you. It is what you hear from everyone who works on these movies. She is like genuinely beloved by younger audiences. And lacking a big IP does seem to hurt stars. I think we should point out that Glenn Powell, for instance, snuck onto last year's list in the top 100 on the heat of Twisters, but has fallen back to 178 on this year's chart. Maybe The Running Man will cement his place in the firmament. Who knows? But Glenn Powell, not quite a movie star yet. Alyssa, why do the elderly dominate our list of movie stars? Why is this list getting older?
The not quite statistics dork in me just wants to say, like, we don't actually have serious longitudinal data here to indicate that movie stars are getting older, right? Like, we don't have data on this from, like, 1945, 1955, 1965. And so I want to be careful about saying that movie stars are getting older. But to a certain extent, movie stars are getting older because it's been a while since a generation of young, promising actors had a lot of non-franchise movies to star in that sort of created their brands in a way that was going to be sort of durable and portable, right? I mean, you know, the decline of the romantic comedy, for example, right? If you had done this in like 1995, you have to imagine that like someone like Meg Ryan would have been very high on the list, sort of on the backs of her collaborations with Nora Ephron. You know, someone like Sandra Bullock, I think, clearly would have been a big name on that list, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. Again, you know, she was both doing romantic comedies. She was starring in things like Speed, John Grisham movies. I think, you know, what we're seeing is less about movie stars being old than about Hollywood's star-making machinery having faltered at a certain point. I want to say the thing that made me feel oldest about this list is the fact that Leonardo DiCaprio is 50. I mean, I like when Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet came out and he was like dewy and gorgeous, that was like one of the seminal movie-going events of my young adulthood. And so the idea that he's like 50 years old just makes me feel like I am in imminent danger of crumbling into dust.
Well, he aged weirdly also. He played like 25 until he was 38 or something, right? And then he like only barely started playing like I'm a guy in my 30s. And I don't mean necessarily that the roles were literally defined as this is a 25-year-old, but yeah. He played a kind of unnaturally young sort of type for a long time into his career. And only when he hit 40 did he start playing slightly older. And then even it was like The Revenant was the first time you sort of started to see him as like, oh, this is someone who has aged a little bit. He didn't allow himself to age on screen.
Yeah.
I want to mention something else here, because Alyssa brings this up about not having great longitudinal data in terms of what...
Or at least not as presented in the article that we're talking about in the survey we're talking about. Yeah.
This NRG study is, I think, only 3 or 4 years old. It's not a long study. But there are polls about, you know, who do people consider movie stars, right? So in his book, William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade, he writes about the Quigley Publishing Company had a poll of stars. They would poll theater owners and ask who you think the biggest star is. And it's really interesting. Like, he goes over kind of 5-year periods. And from 1971 to 1981, so 71, 76, and 81, every 5 years, I think the only name that's on all of those lists is Clint Eastwood. Yeah. So Clint Eastwood shows up on all those lists. But then it's like, you know, in 1981, the biggest stars, according to the theater owners, were guys like Bill Murray, Alan Alda, Dolly Parton, Harrison Ford in 81, right? Mm-hmm. And then you look at 76 and it's like Jack Nicholson, Mel Brooks, Al Pacino, Woody Allen. Again, there's an interesting kind of range of ages and new faces. And again, this is different than asking movie theater owners is a little bit different than asking
audiences,
because they're looking for slightly different things. But I do think there has been a real stagnation, Peter, that we've seen a flattening of the I mean, the fact that Denzel Washington, who I love Denzel Washington. We all love Denzel Washington. Everybody loves Denzel Washington. But, like, should he be the number one movie star in the world? He's been doing this for a long time.
Yeah. No, and I think that, I mean, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about the way that franchises kind of consume actors, right? And kind of subsume them into the IP that they are embodying. And, I mean, I think a lot of this is, like, Zendaya and Timothée Chalamet are big movie stars in part because they're not completely swallowed up by IP, right? Like, you know, Timmy's doing Dune, they're both doing Dune, but like she's doing Challengers and Euphoria. He's doing, you know, A Complete Unknown. Like they're all, you know, or like Bones and all. They are people who have time in their schedules to act in actual movies, not just franchise exercises. And if that's what makes a movie star, the more time promising young actors play in franchises, the less time they're going to have to do other things.
I would put it a little bit differently, though. I agree with a lot of what Alyssa said here. Just on the sort of aging, have stars aged question, I think it's pretty clear that if you go back to the kind of modern Hollywood era that began in the late 60s or early 70s and through the 70s through about the early aughts, the typical stars were men in their 30s and 40s, maybe into their early 50s, and women in their 20s and 30s. That was the age range and the type. And now we see it's even more heavily male, and it's frequently it's over 50. And even with Denzel Washington getting to the age of 70, right? It's a lot of guys who are hitting who you think of as young, but are now like Leonardo DiCaprio hitting 50, or Tom Cruise in his, you know, 60s now. I would say that what we are seeing here is the results of an explicit and concerted effort not to create movie stars. Because if you go back to the late aughts in particular, 2005 to 2012, the era when Marvel was launching, and Marvel is a big part of this story, but it's not the only part, but when Marvel was launching its cinematic universe, there was this idea that movie stars were something of a problem because movie stars have opinions, because movie stars want to do things that make them look good, because movie stars are harder to control. They have power on the set over creative decisions, over what movies get made, all of that sort of thing. And Spider-Man, the IP, Iron Man, the IP, Star Wars, the IP, does not itself have opinions. Now, there are considerations about IP. There are fans, as we have learned. But in fact, yes, yes, Alyssa, there are fans and they have opinions and you do have, right? So it's not that these things have sort of no built in, no considerations or nothing that you have to kind of manage, right? But IP is executive driven. Especially the bigger and more sprawling the franchise gets, the longer it lives, right? These are sort of corporate controlled, group controlled things that can be run out of the executive's office much more than you are running them out of, in conjunction with the movie star who is probably going to be there as an executive producer and is going to have a lot of strong opinions about what this movie should be. Just as an aside, I'm not even sure where I saw it. It's probably in the 12 Monkeys DVD, but I can just distinctly remember some background footage of Bruce Willis arguing with Terry Gilliam on the set of 12 Monkeys about like exactly what this character should be doing at this time, right? And Terry Gilliam was arguably not the most powerful person on that film, even though he was the director who I believe had Final Cut written into his contract so long as he delivered a movie under 2 hours and 15 minutes because nobody wanted another Brazil debacle, right? And that was a common thing. Yeah. And this is not, it's, I'm not going to sit here and say that no superhero star, has ever had an opinion on set that had to be listened to. Robert Downey Jr. certainly has, right? Like he is someone who, but like this was an effort to get rid of movie star power and to quash it for something that executives thought was more controllable. And it was an effort that for a decade or so did in fact work. They were right. Like if you go back to the 2010s, the movies that did best for the studios were not star driven. They were much more IP driven. And in fact, it was understood that the stars were at least potentially interchangeable. How many Spider-Mans have we had? Terrence Howard was, moved out of the first Iron Man, after the first Iron Man, out of the War Machine role because he demanded too much money. And they were like, nope. And, and part of it was just not control. It was also just money. These stars are, command incredibly large paychecks. And the executives were like, look, if we're spending $100 million on a movie and the star costs 25 or 30, right? Which was true in the 1990s. Yeah. I mean, we talk about these $30 million paychecks now, but Jim Carrey talks about like the $20 million check he wrote himself and carried around that until he could one day cash that $20 million check. I don't think he actually cashed it, like in the sense of taking home $20 million in a suitcase, but he like had a $20 million payday and then had a series of them. And that was, I won't say common, but that was the thing that the executives were trying to head off, both as a creative endeavor or sort of, and you might almost call it an anti-creative endeavor, but like both to head off the sort of creative conflicts that came with movie stars and then also the considerable cost of them. And so now it's not surprising that after 10 or 15 or 20 years of explicit attempts by the movie industry to not have movie stars, all the movie stars are people from before that happened.
Can I also add just one thing really quickly? Because Sunny, I was thinking about your point about sort of stars being men in their 30s and 40s. And I think part of what we're seeing here is also a reflection of the way that sort of men's bodies and conditioning have changed, right? I mean, Tom Cruise is doing things that I don't think anyone would have expected a 60-whatever-year-old to do 40 years ago, right? And there is sort of a system of training and expectation for what men can do, a sense that men are being sort of very viable.
Cruise would have been playing kind of elderly mentor roles as third build with younger actors, yes, now, rather than
being the action star. And
if he were
stunts.
This age in 1994.
Right. I mean, like, Denzel Washington is still making Equalizer movies. Now, are there body doubles? There's a lot of other stuff going on. But there is this sense that men are viable as action stars. I mean, and women too, to a certain extent. But men really are sort of staying in those prime action star roles simply for a longer amount of time.
Yeah.
And there's a core audience for that, yeah, too, right? And that audience is a lot of guys in their 40s and 50s. It's, yeah, I mean, yes, some in their 20s and 30s. And this goes to the movie that we're going to talk about today, which is this weird nearly decade later follow-up to a kind of middling action movie, yeah, that positions Ben Affleck as an action star. And how old is Ben Affleck now? He's got to be 50 something, yeah. Right? He's a decade older than me.
Yeah. No, yeah. And it's like the promise is that you too, through like some testosterone replacement and protein powder, will be able to kill cartel leaders well into your 50s, maybe your 60s. Like, you too can be the accountant.
Part of this is the aging of movie going audiences themselves, 100%. Right? And this this is a thing that, you know, outside of something like Minecraft, which has broad appeal with the younger folks, or you know, the Gentle Minions craze of a couple years back, right? Movie going audiences are getting slightly older. I don't want to overstate it. It's not like the movie going audience is the opera audience or anything, but it's definitely getting a little bit older, and people do like to see people. If you're going to the movie theaters, you want to see somebody who reflects your station in life, and also you recognize, right? And that definitely plays a part of it. I want to hit on one thing real quick that I think is interesting, and that's the inclusion of Adam Sandler on this list. So Adam Sandler's on this list, which is very funny because Adam Sandler has not made a theatrical movie since, I think, 2019. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure he has made only Netflix movies since then. I'm just looking at his IMDb. Hubie Halloween, Hustle, Murder Mystery 2, You Are So Not Invited to My Bar Mitzvah, Bat Mitzvah, Leo, Spaceman. That's six movies in the last 5 years, all of them on Netflix. And his last was Uncut Gems, which did pretty well for a indie A24 movie, you know, about a gambling addict who wants to give everybody in the audience a heart attack with his shenanigans. so that movie did fine, but I would not describe it as a huge hit. Which leads me to a question about, you know.
Though it's had a long cultural shelf life. I mean, that movie is remembered much better than a lot of things that did better at the box office that year.
This kind of leads into my point, which is that there is a methodology issue with this poll, which it feels like it's more of a name recognition poll than anything else. Like, name people who you like to see in movies as kind of a stand-in for whether or not you will buy tickets. And I have long had a theory that this actually... this is the last place where the movie star actually matters is the world of streaming, which is what I mean is in the world of streaming, you have a homepage you go to, you're flipping through tiles. You're like, what do I want to watch? And you see a face you recognize. And you're like, oh, I like Adam Sandler. I'll watch this Adam Sandler movie. I like The Rock. I like Dwayne Johnson. I'll watch this, Netflix original.
It's a streaming era version of the thing that we saw constantly with action movies, direct-to-DVD action movies in the aughts and tens. Bruce Willis in particular would show up for one or two days of shooting. They'd put his face on the cover, pay him half of the budget for the film. And it was like, oh, this has Bruce Willis in it, even if he's really only in two scenes.
But it's not quite like that because these are the actual stars of them. Like they're real movies. And they are really in them. And these are actors who are in their prime. Again, like Dwayne Johnson makes, Red Notice and Red One. And he's got the whole Red cinematic universe. And those are big hits. Red Notice was a big hit for Netflix, regardless of whether or not you like the movie. Red One was an enormous hit for Prime Video. It's kind of under-discussed, actually, how well that did on Prime Video. The entertainment strategy guy's been all over it. This is the one area where, as frustrating as I find the world of streaming and the economics of streaming and all that, and what streaming is trying to do to movie theaters, it's the one place where star power actually really still matters, is the world of streaming. And that kind of complicates this question of like, well, who would you pay to go see in a movie theater? I don't know.
I'm not sure there's a better way to get the data, though. I mean, you can just look at global, you know, at the thing that agents have always done, which is this actor or this director or whoever has, you know, however many billions in global box office to their name, to their projects. But that gets you Samuel Jackson as being the most bankable star ever, just because he's been around for a long time, and he was in Star Wars and Marvel. right? And like, as in supporting roles. And I'm not saying he's not a bankable star. He absolutely is. At the same time, it's a different story between him and Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Or, you know, Sam Worthington because of the avatars. I literally had to be like, Sam Whatington, somethington.
Jake Sully.
Yes, Jake Sully.
Jake Sully. All right.
One of the blue guys.
Not even the most memorable blue guy.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a controversy that stars are getting older, like all of us, towards the grave? Alyssa.
It's a controversy. Death is inevitable.
Peter.
It's a controversy. And in fact, it's showing that death might not be inevitable for some of us.
We're never going to die.
And that's great. We're all going to age into being more beautiful versions of ourselves, like Tom Cruise.
Sounds awesome.
That's trickle down technology.
All of our of us will retire and become the Equalizer in Italy.
It's a controversy, but it is interesting. Yeah. It's an interesting versus. I don't know. It's just kind of interesting. I don't know what to make of it, except for the fact that we are all getting older. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday when we're going to be discussing Star Wars nostalgia on the back of Revenge of the Sith's huge weekend box office haul. Indeed, it made more money than The Accountant 2 in its opening weekend. Speaking of which, on to the main event. The Accountant 2, picking up 8 years after The Accountant, which saw Ben Affleck playing an autistic savant who both helped criminal organizations hide their money and who also happens to be very good at killing people, just really good with guns and stuff for some reason because of the autism, especially with the help of his hitman brother Braxton, played by John Bernthal.
So fact check. I don't think the autism makes him good at killing. I think his crazy like commando father made him good at killing, and the autism makes him good at accounting and country line dancing.
You can't just pick and choose. It's the autism does it all. It's a magic drug, as we see. As the movie goes along. The sequel is both funnier than the original, and it's a little bit tighter than the first, with a handful of pretty fantastic action sequences. I don't know, I enjoyed it fine. We open on the execution of a former Treasury Department official played by J.K. Simmons, who I did not rewatch the original. You might want to just read the Wikipedia before you go, because I had for some reason thought that movie was about trying to figure out who killed J.K. Simmons, but actually that movie is about J.K. Simmons trying to figure out who killed Jeffrey Tambor, if I remember correctly. Jeffrey Tambor not in this movie, for the record. He is still very canceled. J.K. Simmons has been trying to track down a missing woman and her child as a private investigator. As he dies in this hit on his life, he scrawls "Find the Accountant" on his arm, which leads Mary Beth Medina, played by Cynthia Adiah Robinson, to get in touch with Christian Wolf, the titular accountant, to try and figure out what precisely her former boss had gotten himself into. Yeah. Anyway, when I say this movie is funnier, what I mean is like the first time we see Christian, he's in the midst of a speed dating event where it seems like all, 50 or 100 women at the thing have shown up just for him. Why? Well, glad you asked. He used his autism superpower to rig the survey and make him seem more appealing than he actually is. It's a good gag. It's a good gag, particularly when he blows it.
And then they all meet him and he's like, let me tell you about
math. Exactly. He blows it because he has to actually talk to these. He has to talk to these women. It's very awkward.
And the inevitability of death
for everyone. Anyway, the whole movie kind of plays like a buddy comedy with Bernthal and Affleck serving as the odd couple at the heart of the picture. The plot is ridiculous. And when I say this movie is tighter, I mean that it doesn't do a lot. The first one had a lot of digressions back to Jeffrey Tambor in prison and raising these autistic super killers and whatever. And this is much more straightforward. It's still weirdly complicated. There's a whole thing about human trafficking. There's also a woman who has a brain injury that turns her into a super killer, which again is like an underrated kind of through line of these movies, the way like neuroatypical brain damage turns into a sort of superpower. They're all autistic X-Men. There's a sequence in the sequel where kids at a home for neuroatypical children work on hacking a bunch of computers to track someone down. And it really plays like they might as well have put like a billboard out front that says Charles Xavier School for Gifted Children as they go down into the basement of this thing. It's really, it's very funny. I don't know. I at least I find it very funny. I'm sure it's terribly offensive to, you know, actual autistic people, but like I this is like the way that it uses the way this movie uses autistic people is very funny to me. Anyway, The Accountant 2 is a prime example of why John Bernthal is one of the best actors in the game today. I want to be very clear on this. Every time he shows up in the movie, I was like rolling in my seats. I was hooting and hollering, as the kids say. He's just very funny as Braxton, the kind of no-nonsense hitman who is stymied precisely one time in this film when he's trying to adopt a puppy a few weeks early. He's just insanely charismatic and funny to watch, particularly when paired with a great straight man like Affleck. Like, without Bernthal, this movie is, it's like a two-star movie. Maybe it's entertaining enough in places, but it would not work with Bernthal. It's a 3-star movie, which is like, it doesn't bump it up to a must see, but it's like, it's fun. It's fun to watch. You can go see this in theaters and have a good time, which is about all you want from something like The Accountant 2. Peter, what did you make of The Accountant 2?
I did not think it was a very good movie, and I also really enjoyed it. And that is a rare thing. And so the premise here is obviously the sort of the thing that we want to talk about most, which is, right, what if you had a kind of Asperger's-y autism, and it made you not only really good at math, but also turned you into John Wick? And I think contra Alyssa, it really is that the autism is part of his John Wick-like murder skills. And yes, his brother also, who is his non-autistic brother, also has something like those murder skills. But what we're seeing, like in the line dancing sequence, to the extent that it matters to the plot, is, which basically not at all, is that Ben Affleck's character is able to do sort of complex physical maneuvers and sort of get a sense of like patterns and that sort of thing in a way that other people are not. And that is what is making him an excellent killer slash not just with guns. Remember, there's a bit at the beginning in the pizza making facility in which he also shows off that he's like great with the punching and the jujitsu type, you know, kung fu type moves. And he's not quite John Wick level, but like, it's complicated stuff, and he's good at it because I guess he doesn't understand human emotions or something. It's totally ridiculous and fairly enjoyable, again, because of that buddy comedy aspect. And so the thing, and that is the thing that I think is under-remarked upon and that makes this movie kind of shaggily enjoyable, is it's not just the buddy comedy aspect of it. It's that this movie made a decision you don't see very often today, which is to leave in a bunch of scenes that don't have a direct relevance to the plot. So that opening bit with the where he's at the dating conference that he has hacked, if you took it out, the only thing you would lose is an establishing fact that he is kind of a weirdo nerd in a charming
and
but
is like
awkward
interested
way.
In right? you relationship.
So except that through line for both of these brothers, they're both looking for connection in a world that has denied it to them, never really pays off in the larger action plot at all. It's a separate movie in which these two brothers, one of whom is not able to sort of connect with people emotionally, the other of whom, played by Bernthal, seems more normal, but also does not have any. He says, "I've got nobody in the world." I'm right. He's trying to get a puppy, but maybe he's actually a cat person because puppies. I will tell you this, as somebody with a puppy, puppies take a lot of work, right? And so there are just a bunch of these scenes. There's a great one where they sit on top of the Airstream trailer and drink Budweiser in their underwear, right? And just sort of talk about what it's like to be brothers and have a dad who was like emotionally difficult. And if you took that scene out, the movie would still make exactly as much sense as an action movie, as a thriller, as it does now, which is to say not very much, but just enough to sort of get you through things. There's another scene in which they go to this country bar. There's some country line dancing, they get into a fight. If you took that scene out, the movie would play exactly as coherent plot-wise, sort of in terms of the main arc of the plot, as it does now. And so there's a whole bunch of these. The movie manages to have all of these kind of lived-in moments that are not directly necessary to the plot, but are just enjoyable to watch. Two pretty good, not quite full-on A-plus movie stars. None of them made our NRG list, right? But like two kind of movie star caliber actors who are enjoyable on screen, have a great dynamic, and you just like seeing them hang out together. And this is something that I think movies used to have much more of when there were sort of fewer controls on screenplays and on screenplay structure. Not to say that there wasn't any kind of control, but there was this sense that, like, you need moments where these characters can just be themselves in their world. This movie gives us a lot of those moments of these guys just being themselves in their world. And so when things get completely ridiculous, as they do increasingly throughout the movie, and when the shooting starts, really, I mean, very much the whole third act is just a big action sequence, and you're tempted to kind of like say, what the hell? This doesn't make any real sense. Like, how do they even get these kids back from Mexico after driving the school bus? Like, is the border crossing going to be? Like, who knows? Who knows?
Why
right?
are the kids who knows? There?
I don't know. I don't.
Why are the kids there?
No. That is actually, I was wondering about, I thought about that. It's very clear if you think about it. So in one of the early scenes where the scene where John Bernthal first shows up in Los Angeles, they interview two prostitutes. I should say interview. They talk to three prostitutes. And one of them is the one who will talk to them for money. They have to give her enough money that she can go truly escape and make her own life, not just a couple of $100s. And then she says at the end, as a way of explanation, though you don't understand it at the time, I don't have children. And the thing is that the children are there basically to make sure that they're quasi-slave labor, human trafficking at people, whether they are working as prostitutes or whether they are working in the pizza factory, that those people cannot escape, right?
They're hostages.
They're hostages because of the kids. And so the kids are kept there.
That I understood, except there, it seemed like they were building this up to be some sort of, like, again, the kid that they rescue is himself autistic, I think, is like what we're kind of hinted at, which, like, again, it.
To explain that further, it doesn't really make any sense, but I would have to spoil one of the things.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. But
it's a good hangout movie, and it's good because it's Shaggy and doesn't sort of strictly limit itself to we're just going to go through the plot beats, but also manages to do this in a completely tolerable 2 hours and 6 minutes.
It does move along nicely, which is, again, for a movie that has as many scenes, as Peter says, that aren't strictly speaking necessary for the plot mechanics of the film. It does really move along, but that's because the plot mechanics of the film, again, this is a hangout movie. This is not a John Wick action movie. It is not something that depends upon the action really working, though it does. I think Gavin O'Connor does a very good job of directing this film, and it all comes together. But it's just about hanging out with these two brothers, which is the best part. Anyway, Alyssa, what did you make of The Accountant 2?
I largely agree with what the two of you have said, but I want to return to something you said in your intro about, like, sort of whether or not the depiction of autism in this movie is offensive. What I want to note is the way in which I think this movie and its sequel have kind of tracked an argument about autism that has been happening sort of in the public and public policy discourse. Because in the first movie, Ben Affleck's character is a lot more debilitated, right? He is sort of more socially rigid. You see him doing these exercises where, like, he listens to metal and, like, you know, is sort of like stimming with, like, you know, like muscle rollers or something on his legs to try and sort of calm himself down and center himself. His assistant at Harbor Neuroscience is, you know, sort of herself much more, sort of much more affected, maybe debilitated is the wrong word, but, like, significantly more sort of affected by whatever her neurodivergence is. And in sort of public discourse about disability, there have been a lot of conversations about autism and neurodivergence as kinds of superpowers. You know, this has creeped into the way that people talk about ADHD, for example. And there is a real debate about, you know, the sort of uses and validity of that kind of argument. You know, the parents of, you know, some kids who have what are so-called level 3 diagnoses, you know, who are going to need very high levels of care for their entire lives, have sort of pushed back against the idea that autism is a superpower. The New York Times actually had a piece from a mother recently about, you know, there was a strong reaction against Robert F. Kennedy Jr. saying, talking about people with autism as people who are like never going to play taxes or pay taxes or play catch or sort of participate in society in other ways. And this mom was saying, you know, there was a really strong backlash against that from people who are less severely affected. But in fact, that is kind of my reality. And how do you have a public policy discussion that kind of includes the full range of autism spectrum diagnoses? And so to see The Accountant kind of, you know, which was an odd movie when it was initially released, right? And is still like, it's still sort of an odd mini franchise, but I think that its treatment of autism as superpower is very much in keeping with the way that some of those arguments and public conversations have changed over, you know, the sort of last 8-9 years since the first one came out. And I just found that, I find that sort of interesting, you know, especially as we're sort of gearing up for a big public discussion of, you know, what we know about autism and how best to treat it. So I find it sort of an interesting entry in this public conversation. And also John Bernthal is great.
The other little grace note, it's again not dwelled on, or this is definitely not like a message movie or a kind of political tract in any straightforward sense. This is a movie about Salvadoran immigration, right? Like this is a movie about the exact thing that we are, that like A1 headlines in the Post and the Times are all about for the last couple of months, in a way that I don't think could possibly have been planned whenever the script was written or when this movie was shot. And yet it's always kind of interesting when those things sort of, when you see a pop culture production that definitely was not intending to comment on the news, but kind of ended up
rhyming with it. Yeah.
Inadvertently having some of those elements, despite the fact that it could not have possibly been planned.
It is. But again, it like is done in such a weirdly perfunctory and also just kind of dumb manner. Like, I don't know. We need a proper human trafficking movie. Not like A Working Man or The Accountant 2. Something that actually deals with this in a real way.
Though I will say, just a final thing, is that what I texted you guys when I got out of the movie is this movie pays off the premise of A Working Man, in which Jason Statham was supposed to take down a bunch of human traffickers and instead didn't. I mean, I guess he shot some Russians, but it's like,
it was all part of, it's all part just, of a bigger,
this
thing.
Movie pays off the premise.
Bigger, it was a bigger thing.
Yeah. This movie pays off the premise of A Working Man much better than A Working Man.
Well, it pays off its own premise in the sense of it. Christian Wolfe is frequently using his, accounting superpowers to do things and draw connections. And he doesn't actually do any accounting really in this. It's not like the first one. First one had this whole great,
he does some pizza box
the
math.
There is.
He shows how the pizza guy
pizza
is
box math.
Is cheating on his taxes by counting the pizza boxes.
A little bit
boxes.
Of pizza box math. It's true. But there's no wall of whiteboards with numbers on it. That's what I want. A beautiful mind, like with numbers flying around. And
my husband was also very disappointed by the lack of accounting.
There's not a lot. There is a little bit. I will say there is not. It's not completely devoid of accounting.
Maybe The Accountant, because this was like not just sort of The Accountant 2, but like The Accountant squared. Maybe The Accountant cubed will be like 9 hours of accounting movie.
I could watch that. I could just real time of him in one room for one night solving accounting problems.
The accounting in the first movie and the sort of all of the little gimmicks, the kind of accounting like gimmicks that are not like fully whiteboarded, but you get in the second movie, make a little bit more sense when you realize this movie was written by Bill Dubuque, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who is also the creator of Ozark, a TV show that is basically about accounting for the cartels.
Interesting. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Accountant to Alyssa?
Thumbs up, like quite enjoyable, but as Peter said, maybe not that good.
Peter.
Same. Thumbs up, but it's not like a good movie. This is a thumbs up for entertainment and value. Entertainment value.
Entertainment value is the highest thing a movie can aspire to. Thumbs up. Okay, that's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.